President Trump abandon an ally, the Kurdish militia in Syria. Veterans are sounding off on that decision and the personal connections they made with Kurds.
When you think about having dinner with somebody and then you leave, it becomes more than just a political issue. It becomes a relational issue.
And not far from the front lines in Syria, hospital workers are pleading for help.
We desperately, desperately here need a no-fly zone. We desperately, desperately need the U.S. or Russia to start stopping Turkey from flying planes over us, because this is what is smashing people, what is killing people.
Also, two feminist writers share the prestigious Booker Prize, including Margaret Atwood.
I rather foolishly decided I was going to be a writer when I was 16, and that was Canada in the 50s, and nobody was a writer.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Violence is surging in northern Syria. The Turkish military offensive is entering its second week, and Syrian government forces are also streaming into the area. On the ground, hundreds of thousands of civilians have been displaced and dozens killed. Some of the wounded have found their way to a hospital not far from the front lines in Tel Tamer, Syria. That's where we reached Tanya Brown. She's a UK citizen who's been volunteering in Syria's Kurdish-controlled regions. And a warning to listeners, some of her descriptions of scenes in the hospital are quite graphic.
I'm not actually a medic, I'm a bike mechanic, but kind of all hands on deck because there's so many injured people coming in from Serakanye and from other places that the Turkish army are just smashing. Yeah.
What kind of wounds are you seeing? What kind of injuries?
Everything. Burns, people with amputations, people with like large bits of meat missing from their body. Generally, yeah, really, really horrible stuff.
Are you treating civilians as well as fighters?
Yes, there are still civilians here. There are still doctors working in the hospital. There are still people coming here to volunteer to help. There are still cleaning workers. We're like trying to run the hospital as we normally would, despite the situation.
Have you had to treat any children?
Yes. There was one child yesterday with really terrible, terrible burns from like the top half of his body down and all the way down to his waist, pretty much.
From your perspective, are civilians bearing the brunt of these battles or are the fighters?
Civilians. The day before, yes, I'm a bit confused about days because I kind of don't sleep because we just are in the hospital 24/7 working, pretty much. Civilians are leaving their homes are being destroyed, people are terrified, the planes come over and they make really, you know, even if they don't drop bombs, they make terrifying noises, scare people. There was a convoy 2 days ago, I think, which was entirely civilian, which got hit. There were 11 deaths and 74 injured. They all ended up in our hospital, so we just bring people in, off ambulances or whatever, and take care about them and then send them. Like, mostly people are not conscious or people are like really scared. It's just loads and loads of patients. Like the other day, I must have treated 40 people in one day. And I'm not a professional medic, you know.
In the course of your job there at the hospital, do you have to be armed yourself?
No, we are working as civilians in the hospital. We work with the Kurdish Red Crescent.
Do you have any sense from where you are of how the Kurdish militias are holding up?
Not really. I mean, we get a lot of injured, generally. And, yeah, like, I mean, my impression is that, like, people are just getting smashed. Like, you know, there's, with the extent of the injuries that are coming in, with the bombings, with everything else. Of course, like, a ground army can't stand up against planes. We desperately, desperately here need a no-fly zone. We desperately, desperately need the U.S. or Russia to start stopping Turkey from flying planes over us, because this is what is smashing people, what is killing people.
Many
you know, if it was like a fair fight, like I think there might be a chance, but it's not a fair fight.
Many Kurds for decades, or for more than 100 years, have been dreaming of establishing an autonomous Kurdish state. Is that no longer a possibility with this latest action?
I don't know. Hang on. Sorry. I'm on the phone. The idea here isn't to establish like a Kurdish state. The idea is to establish democratic confederalism, which is where like people work together and people live together and people self-organize. So there's not like a government in a sense of like a nation state government, but people like organize for their locality and they organize what's good for them. And this is really, really a positive thing. Like, I've been living here now for 9 months and I've experienced the way that works, and it works to unite people. You know, there are people here from loads of different backgrounds, Assyrians, Arabs, Kurds, now loads of internationals, you know, and it works. Everyone works together. And like, it's healing a divide that's been in this country for a long, long time. Okay. Sorry, my Wi-Fi hotspot's having to leave now.
Okay.
So I'm going to have to go.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Sorry.
Tanya Brown is a UK citizen who's been volunteering in the Kurdish-controlled area in northern Syria for 9 months now. She's working at a hospital, and that's where we spoke to her from. Humanitarian aid groups operating in northern Syria are dealing with a rapidly changing situation.
The last 5 days have been almost like living in a movie for many of us doing this work, because the situation doesn't change on a daily basis. It's actually changed on an hourly basis.
That's Sonia Kush at Save the Children in Amman, Jordan. The Ruth Rupa Shenoy talked to her and other humanitarian aid organizations in the region, and she's here with me now. Rupa, first off, what actual aid is getting through to people in northern Syria? Is it food, medicine?
In some cases, but there are also camps that are having problems getting the very basics, like water, because at least one water station has been shelled. There are hospitals that are open, but there are lots of concerns that as more people are displaced, those hospitals will be overwhelmed and supply lines will be disrupted as the fighting spreads and moves.
What about the ability of aid workers who are there to talk with each other and organize or reach the very people they're trying to serve?
So far, it's still okay, and organizations have also been able to track many of the people who've already fled internally. Some have gone to new camps, and they're calling those camps collective centers, and UN organizations are getting food to those centers. But some of the centers weren't quite ready to receive the influx of people, and if the influx continues, they might be overwhelmed.
Are there aid workers still in the area? I mean, have they been able to stay as these different troops move in?
Most international staff has been pulled out. Many of the aid workers who are still there are Syrian, some who have been displaced themselves. Save the Children has about 500 staffers still working. Some humanitarian groups are being more secretive with their numbers in the hopes that that might help them protect those workers.
That's interesting. So they feel like they need to protect them, that they're at risk.
Definitely, just like the civilians in the area are. But also, there's the fact that many humanitarian organizations are only authorized to work in areas that aren't under the control of the Syrian government. So, of course, the Kurds' alliance with the Syrian government has really changed things. When government forces arrive, aid workers have to leave. And just the possibility of that happening seems to be causing a lot of confusion and panic. This is Carl Schembre of the Norwegian Refugee Council.
There are areas where rumors spread like wildfire that troops are approaching, that the fighting is approaching, and aid workers, just like the rest of the community, would have to flee. Then by evening, they might realize it wasn't as close as they thought, and they might return. So it's extremely chaotic.
And I should say, the Norwegian Refugee Council is one of 15 major aid organizations operating in Syria that got together and issued a joint statement pleading with all governments involved to protect civilians as much as possible while all of this unfolds.
And I want to ask about those camps that were housing women and children who had links to ISIS. What's happened to them and the people in them?
Actually, to go back to Sonia Kush at Save the Children, they work in those camps. She says there are more than 9,000 foreign children from 40 different countries that are still there.
In this rapidly changing context, it's going to get much harder to continue to deliver humanitarian assistance to that very vulnerable group of children. And we're strongly calling on governments to follow the lead of the U.S. government in repatriating their children and giving them a chance at a healthy and productive childhood back home in their own countries.
Wow, it's a pretty complicated situation. Rupa, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
In the chaos in northern Syria, hundreds of prisoners linked to the Islamic State or ISIS are escaping. That's stoking fears of an ISIS resurgence. President Trump is warning Turkey to halt its offensive. He's imposing economic sanctions on the country, and Europeans are also calling for action against Turkey. Katalin Cech is a Hungarian member of the European Parliament, where she's part of the liberal Renew Europe group. She joins us from Frankfurt and says her group is deeply concerned and calling on EU foreign Minister Federica Mogherini to act.
We are afraid of the potential geopolitical consequences. We are afraid of destabilization of the region and also of the resurgence of previously captured ISIS fighters. So therefore, we are calling on Turkey to stop the operations. And also, we are calling on Ms. Mogherini to consider a potential EU-wide arms export bans when it comes to Turkey.
How does what your group Renew Europe wants differ from what Europe's already doing? Has the EU not presented a unified approach to what's happening in Syria?
We already saw certain countries applying sanctions, but we would like to see a joint European response to it, because we believe that we Europeans, we share a lot of concerns about the regions. Unfortunately, when the conflict started at the first point, my Prime Minister Viktor Orban from Hungary applied his veto on a joint European statement. So therefore, Europe was late to the game. I'm happy to see that the majority of European countries are in the line of taking action and standing up against the ongoing war. And I do hope that very soon, also the Hungarian Prime Minister could consider the seriousness of the situation.
Now, the issue of potential Syrian refugees is out there. How should Europeans address that, given that they've already absorbed several million Syrian refugees?
So I do believe that Mr. Erdogan is just using empty threats and empty words. I think the European Union should be refused to be blackmailed, and Turkish side should stop the operations very soon and also stop applying those threats to the European Union.
And you're referring to Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan saying, you know, I'm going to unleash more Syrian refugees if you, say, you know, impose sanctions.
Yes, I do believe that this is a blackmailing attempt for on the side of President Erdogan, and the European Union should refuse to be engaged in this discussion.
How has the president of your own country, Viktor Orban, responded to the issue of refugees? Hungary has famously not been terribly welcoming to Syrian refugees in the past.
Mr. Orban has been using the refugee crisis for his own internal political goals and purposes. He was clearly not interested in finding a European-wide solution to handling the crisis, because until very recently, it was his political bargaining chip back home.
There was recently an election in Hungary, your home country. What does that mean for Hungary's relationship with Turkey? Any changes there?
Well, first of all, I think that is a change of Hungary's relationship with the EU, as we finally elected a pro-European leadership in most of our major cities who share the concern for human rights and who share a shared European approach for peace. So therefore, I'm hopeful that the recently elected Hungarian local leaders will also join the EU in effort of calling for peace and stability in the region, and also when it comes to Turkey relations.
What's your reaction to the U.S. imposing sanctions on Turkey?
So I doubt that U.S. sanctions could counterbalance the withdrawal of U.S. troops. That was probably a great part of Mr. Erdogan's launch of operations.
So what is a real solution? I mean, you've mentioned you think the EU has to respond as one, but what can the EU do? What is a real solution?
Well, first of all, that finding a solution requires a real commitment from all member states. So I'm hopeful that in the upcoming legislation, the new European Commission and the new European Parliament can sit down to a table and figure out solutions that actually do work. I think that the situation is escalating very quickly, and I hope that all world powers can call on Turkey with an equal strength to stop the operations and stop destabilizing the region and threatening the lives of so many in the region.
Katalin Cech is a Hungarian member of the European Parliament. She's part of the liberal Renew Europe group. She was speaking to us from Frankfurt. Thanks a lot, Katalin.
Thank you very much.
You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Protests erupted in Barcelona this week. They're being led by supporters of the Catalan independence movement, people who want to see Catalonia break away from the rest of Spain. My BBC colleague Guy Hedgeco is in Barcelona. He says people took to the streets after Spain's Supreme Court handed down jail sentences yesterday to 12 prominent backers of the independence movement.
9 of them were found guilty of sedition, a very serious charge linked to trying to defy the state or overthrow the state. But also several of them were found guilty of misuse of public funds because they were believed to have been involved in organizing this controversial referendum back in 2017, an independence referendum which had been outlawed by the courts but went ahead anyway.
The independence movement was really heated up in 2017. What does it look like today in terms of support for Catalan independence?
Well, the strange thing is the support hasn't really changed. I mean, 2 years ago, Catalonia was pretty much split down the middle on the issue of independence. Catalan society remains very divided on this issue. I think among many more moderate Catalans, a lot of people are rather exhausted by all this. But there are these two sort of fringes on the argument, the sort of hardcore unionists and the hardcore pro-independence camp. And in a way, it benefits each of them for there to be a constant dispute over this issue. It gives them more sort of oxygen. So the more radical elements on both sides are continuing to focus on this issue, and it has been very polarizing.
Yeah, this group called Tsunami Democratique, they tweeted late yesterday that they're going to begin a cycle of nonviolent civil disobedience and said there will be more protests to follow. Who is this new group, Tsunami Democratique?
Well, no one seems to know, really. They're very mysterious. They appeared just a few weeks ago, shortly before we expected the verdict of the Supreme Court case to be announced. And it appeared that they were behind the most sort of dramatic response to the verdict, which was huge crowds of people converging on Barcelona airport yesterday night and causing it to collapse in the sense of preventing many passengers from getting to their flights, causing dozens of flights to be cancelled. And that seemed to be sort of their aim. But we still don't know exactly who they are.
My BBC colleague, Guy Hedgeco, he's been speaking with us from Barcelona. Thanks a lot, Guy.
Thanks very much, Carol. It's a pleasure.
When it comes to Britain leaving the EU, the issue of Northern Ireland has dominated the negotiations for months. But even if Prime Minister Boris Johnson manages to appease those on both sides of the Irish border, there's another problem brewing in Scotland. Ever since the Brexit vote, calls for another referendum on Scottish independence have been growing. Just today, the leader of the Scottish National Party, Nicola Sturgeon, said a second vote on independence must happen next year. The World's Orla Barry went to Scotland to see what Brexit might mean for the future of the United Kingdom.
5 years ago, the Scottish people held their own vote about whether to exit the United Kingdom. The result was close, but not enough to change Scotland's future.
No to independence. Scotland makes its decision and chooses to remain part of the United Kingdom. 55% of voters said no to the question, should Scotland...
Back then, many politicians told Scottish voters it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Now, 5 years later, that once-in-a-lifetime referendum looks likely to get a second run.
It's been a tumultuous day in the history of the United Kingdom, with campaigners celebrating the decision to leave the European Union, which they immediately declared Independence Day.
Almost two-thirds of the Scottish electorate voted against Brexit in 2016. They wanted the UK to remain as part of the EU. But over the last 3 years, the turmoil in Westminster has swayed opinion in Scotland that the Scots would be better off looking after their own affairs. Polls now indicate close to 50% are in favour of separating from the UK.
Most people in Scotland, I think, have looked on in horror at what's happened.
Blair Jenkins is a journalist and formerly the chief executive of the pro-independence campaign for Scotland. He notes that Scotland was once independent. It formed a political union with England in the 1700s. But Jenkins' desire for independence is not driven by a sense of history. In his mind, an independent Scotland would be a more equitable society to live in.
I believe that an independent Scotland would be a happier, healthier and more prosperous country.
But others fear independence would damage the region economically. Scotland receives more in terms of public spending per capita than England or Wales. And its biggest export market is the rest of Britain.
Can you imagine if Scotland was to cut itself off from its main trading partner, England, and the rest of the UK? Business and industry would just wither on the vine.
Struan Stevenson is chief executive of Scottish Business UK, a group of businesses who do not want Scotland to be an independent nation. He's also a former member of the European Parliament. Stevenson says Brexit is already damaging enough for Scotland.
The pound is spiralling downwards against the euro and the dollar. It's incredible. In 2019, apparently a government leaked document suggests if we have no deal, we may be suffering food shortages, medicine shortages. We may have to put the military and the police on the streets to stop civil unrest. It's a gift to the nationalists in Scotland who say, well, we could avoid all this by becoming an independent nation.
But Brexit does appear to be changing minds. Claire Miller voted against independence last time around. She's a city councillor with the Green Party in Edinburgh. Now she says because of Brexit, she's campaigning for independence.
I just thought, no, this is not a path I want to go down. And I could see that Scotland becoming independent would be a way in which we could have more control over what we're doing here while perhaps still being part of Europe.
And it's not just about how Scots, like Claire Miller, view the future for Scotland. Over 200,000 EU citizens also live in the region, and Brexit throws their status into chaos. Some who want to stay in Scotland are now campaigning for independence. They formed a group, EU Citizens for an Independent Scotland. One of its members is Ellen Huffer. She's originally from Germany, but has lived in Scotland for 12 years.
I don't wish to be part of a country that is becoming increasingly xenophobic. After the Brexit referendum, EU Citizens had to really confront themselves with what kind of place they live in.
Public pressure to hold another independence referendum is mounting, and some Scottish politicians are laying the groundwork for holding a second vote. It's making some in the business community anxious. Struan Stevenson of Scottish Business UK says he dreads the idea.
I think that would be the biggest mistake of all. We've had such a successful partnership for more than 300 years with the rest of the UK. If it ain't broke, why try and fix it?
I ask Ellen Huffer what she would do if Scotland voted against independence a second time round.
It is such a difficult question. I have just bought a house with my partner here. But yes, I have no desire to remain in the UK, if that is the case.
You would leave?
I would leave.
Would he go too?
I believe if the independence referendum turned out that way, yes, he would.
And where would you go?
We'll see. That's a new adventure for another day. I'm hoping it will never come to that.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Scotland.
This is The World. A family in London made a choice. No more plastic.
Particularly plastic that can't be reused again and again and again.
That means no pre-wrapped fruit.
5 lemons for £1, fantastic. So that's also a fun thing about, you know, shopping naked. You get to really choose. Okay, sorry.
Naked shopping, coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI and PRX. The US and Turkey are NATO allies, but relations have grown tense this past week. President Trump is warning Turkey to stop its incursion into northern Syria. The administration is imposing economic sanctions, but ties between the two countries are deep. The US Air Force has a huge base in Turkey at a place called Incirlik. Incirlik houses dozens of tactical nuclear weapons. They've been there for years. But with the new crisis, Washington is reviewing plans about how to evacuate the weapons. Lacey Healy is CEO of the foreign policy outlet Inkstick Media and host of the Things That Go Boom podcast. Lacey, what kind of nuclear weapons are we talking about, and why are they in Turkey in the first place?
They are B-61 gravity bombs, which is a very complicated name for a tactical nuclear weapon. There are about 50 of them, and they've been there since the Cold War. They really are Cold War relics that have been there for political purposes, for deterrence of Russia and as part of our NATO alliance. But there's not actually a delivery vehicle in existence in Turkey to take these weapons anywhere. So their real strategic value is a little questionable.
Yeah, so they're just kind of sitting there but can't be used?
Yes, it's essentially a storage depot. Were we to actually use them, we would have to fly a fighter jet to Turkey, pick them up, and then take them to where we were actually planning to use them. So really, along the way, someone would probably notice. So the idea that we were going to really use them is a little bit low. But also, taking them out is incredibly complicated, not least of which because President Erdogan has suggested in the past that were we to remove the weapons from Turkey, he may just go ahead and build his own.
So they're sitting there, but there's concern now because if relations with Turkey continue to founder, there's concern that they could be grabbed by somebody else.
They are not guarded by Turkey's military. They are guarded by Americans. So there's not a lot of concern that, say, the Turkish military might seize these or use them in some way, or that terrorists might come marching in and grab them. They don't have the nuclear codes. But there is some concern that those nuclear codes could be circumvented in some way, that those U.S. troops could be overtaken in some way.
So Washington is now talking about how they might move them. And how would that actually take place? And has it ever been done before?
So it would be very complicated to remove them. This is not saying that we shouldn't do it. We really, at this point, I can't imagine another scenario. We're in a very dangerous situation where we have U.S. nuclear weapons sitting in the middle of a conflict zone. We really should be getting them out. Moving them, though, puts them in all sorts of other potential harm's way, where we would have to be flying them out of Turkey. We would have to have concern of any sort of interception by terrorist groups or other countries or whatever it might be. Just generally, the danger of moving nuclear weapons is a concern.
So but just to be clear, these nuclear weapons are not in the conflict zone right now, but they're near it.
Near the conflict zone. Yes, my apologies. So they're 70 miles in Incirlik is from the Syrian border.
How physically do you move a nuclear bomb? I mean, is it small enough to put on a plane?
They are small enough to put on a plane. So actually, these B-61 gravity bombs are meant to be dropped from fighter jets. So they are able to be transported on an airplane.
And where would they go?
They would go back to the U.S. We would have to bring them back to the U.S. or possibly to another NATO ally.
Well, you mentioned security, and I recall that the Turks blockaded Incirlik Air Base a couple of years ago after the U.S. was accused of backing a failed military coup against President Erdogan. Is that a concern for the U.S. that this base could effectively be blockaded or someone could sort of come in and cause a mess?
So experts, including myself, at the time actually recommended that this was the moment when we really needed to consider getting our nuclear weapons out of Turkey. There were some concerns about the alliance with Turkey. There were some concerns about the stability in Incirlik. And the idea of having U.S. nuclear weapons in the middle of that instability was a real concern. It would be very hard for terrorists or for anyone else to breach the security of the U.S. nuclear weapons and to use them in any way, but it is not impossible. And so having them in that space, having them in a place where they are in harm's way or in potential harm's way is a real concern.
That's Lacey Healy. You can hear her host Things That Go Boom, a podcast about national security from PRX. As we've been reporting, the withdrawal of U.S. troops from northern Syria is having an enormous impact on the Kurdish minority there. Kurdish fighters have served alongside U.S. military personnel for decades in Syria and Iraq. And that's bringing back memories for American military veterans.
My name is George Dumain. In March or April of 1991, I was deployed to the Turkish-Iraqi border for Operation Provide Comfort in the first Gulf War. And I worked in a medical supply company, so we set up a tent city. We set up medical supplies with blankets and baby bottles and medication for the Kurds who had been basically...
Dumain went into northern Iraq to provide relief to Kurdish fighters and their families. This was in 1991, after Saddam Hussein's forces had attacked the Kurds.
The first time I went into the tent city when it started being populated with Kurds was the children that I noticed. They kept running, George Bush number one, George Bush number one. It was really cool to see. They were like so excited. Hey! You know, the recent news... it brought it all up, and you know, all those memories came back, and all those kids now that I saw are all grown men, and they've probably got their own families, and it's just, you know, a really sad thing to think about.
Our next voice is from the second Gulf War, which began in 2003.
My name is Brandon Davis, and I served with the Civil Affairs Detachment in northern Iraq, living and working amongst the Kurds in Duhok. We basically lived among and operated among the Iraqi Kurds there in Duhok and that whole entire region. What we had is the Peshmerga commander gave us a group of Peshmerga to help protect our little safe house complex. It was our experience that they had skin in the game. They had a tradition of fighting. They fought against Saddam's forces for decades. I felt like we're allies. Now I feel like we have basically used them.
Kurdish fighters known as the Peshmerga provided security for U.S. troops in Iraq a decade ago. One final voice is from the current conflict in Syria.
Yeah, my name is Jeremy. I'm a medevac pilot with the U.S. Army, and I spent the better part of 2017 living up in northern Syria in a town called Kobani. Our cooks were Kurds on the camp that we lived on, and they would try to make meals for us that they thought we would want as Westerners. So, you know, fried chicken and tacos and whatever else. And to a man, we looked forward to Thursday nights, which was local night. They would make their kebabs, they would make their baba ganoush, they would make whatever, you know, the local fare was. And we found a way to connect with each other, even in areas where we only had so many translators, over meals and over fellowship at the end of a hard day, where, you know, we don't know what had happened on the battlefield in their lives, but we just knew that these guys that were there guarding us and protecting us and at times feeding us, we were supporting their brothers and sisters in arms with weapons and with money and with food and with training. And so when you think about having dinner with somebody and then you leave them alone and leave them kind of exposed to whatever they're exposed to now, it becomes more than just a political issue. It becomes a relational issue. I mean, it's frustrating because at the same time, you know, I got to trust the leadership that is instilled in the military. You know, we have a chain of command for a reason, right? But on the other hand, I'm a human and I see the human cost. I don't want the lives to have been lost in vain, especially the ones that worked so hard to serve the world, not just me and not just my friends that didn't come into any peril because they were guarding our camp. You know what I mean? And every time I read the news, I just get a little more angry.
Thoughts today about the role that Kurdish forces have had in U.S. military operations. The voices we heard there were George Dumain, Brandon Davis, and Jeremy, who didn't want us to use his last name because he's still active in the military. Our newsroom appreciates hearing from the veterans community to help us with our reporting on defense and the military. Get in touch with us by emailing veterans@theworld.org. That's veterans@theworld.org. Over the summer, we aired a story by Patrick Wynn about how the plastic we put in recycling bins here in the U.S. is creating plastic wastelands in Asia.
As we wade in, warm goop sticks to our shoes. The smoke turns our eyes pink. He says, "Don't be embarrassed if you feel like throwing up."
A few days later, we got this email from a listener in London.
"I really enjoyed your wastelands program, but kept waiting to hear the obvious solution, which is just to consume less. I started to move my family home to a single-use, plastic-free life in 2013. Our home is now 99% single-use, plastic-free. I live in..."
That email from Philippa Robb made us want to know more about how she cut plastic out of her life. So we sent Brenna Daldorf to find out.
Hello.
Come on in.
Philippa and her teenage son live in a house on a quiet street in West London.
Could you introduce me?
That's Hayden. He's 16 and not super enthusiastic about doing a radio interview. The family's just making a shopping list.
Get some stuff for salad, get some fruit for pudding. And then we also make muesli during the week. So we'll go and get some nuts and dates. And then I need to get some coffee. So we'll get some of that.
Perfect.
All plastic free.
18 months ago, Philippa decided to stop buying plastic.
Particularly plastic that can't be reused again and again and again. As I try not to get any new plastic in here at all. And I'm going to get...
She opens up a cupboard full of old plastic containers and starts handing them to Hayden.
So we'll use that one for the cheese and we'll use that one for the dates. Excellent. Okay, would you carry the bag?
We head out on foot to pick up groceries. We stop by this little shop that has a squirrel on its sign. Nutcase.
Yes, because we're all nutcases here.
The shop is full of bins of dates, cranberries, and almonds. Khalil Chadid is the owner.
So do most of the people who come here bring their own things?
Not most of them, but it's getting more and more.
Was she your first customer to come in with her own?
She was definitely one of the first customers there. Kind of persuaded me to do it.
So now...
The poster up there, look, I don't know, well, you can't see it from here. When you go outside, you can have a look.
He's talking about a new poster that he just hung up, inviting customers to bring in their own containers. It's the result of Philippa working on him for months.
Khalil, this is really great. It's lovely. Thank you.
At the next door, Philippa and Hayden pick out loose pieces of fruit instead of the ones that come wrapped in plastic.
We need some lemons. How we get it? Five for a pound? Five lemons for a pound. Fantastic. So that's also a fun thing about, you know, shopping naked. You get to really choose. Okay, sorry.
You probably missed that, but Philippa just called buying unwrapped fruit naked shopping. And her teenage son almost died of embarrassment. He's being a really good sport, but he confesses this is not his idea of a good time.
I just don't much like the public theatre. Unlike your mother, who loves the public theatre.
When we get back to the house, Philippa wants to show me her trash can. It's a family-sized yogurt container.
And this is probably about quarter full, maybe. And this is about 10 days worth of rubbish.
There's a few scraps of fabric, some plastic labels from fruit, and two old whiteout bottles. That's it. This yogurt container of garbage represents all the changes that Philippa has made to cut out single-use plastic and reduce waste. But it didn't all happen in a day. Her journey started 10 years ago when she left a job at the BBC World Service and began teaching people how to ride bikes safely in London. She was working outdoors, seeing birds, trees, flowers.
You know, it sounds a bit sort of kooky, but that really, I think, propelled me forward into thinking, what are we doing to this planet that we live on?
At first, she took baby steps.
Last year, 18 months ago, that was the point I decided, that's it, I've got to a certain point where I could actually realistically just decide I'm not buying anything more wrapped in plastic. And I stopped.
But the decision wasn't without sacrifice.
We missed cheddar cheese. And that mainly comes wrapped in plastic.
Over the years, Philippa has had moments of doubt. Like, do these tiny consumer choices really matter?
You know, I mean, I'm only one person. You know, there are how many billions of us living on this planet?
She says it's getting easier now because there are more people trying to go zero waste.
So I no longer feel as if I really am on the fringes as much as I possibly felt about 6 to 9 months ago.
Philippa mostly travels by bike now. She stopped buying new clothes and she recently decided to stop flying. Hayden's mostly cool with his mom's ideas. He's all for cutting out plastic, at home. But he says it's way harder when he's out with his friends.
I don't particularly like saying, you know, I don't want to be using plastic. Not because I'm ridiculed for it, you know, because now it's seen as a good thing to do. But because it does involve drawing attention to oneself.
But despite the discomfort, Hayden did go talk to the student government at his school about the amount of plastic used in the cafeteria.
And so now we have a paper takeaway box and wooden cutlery, which is an improvement.
Philippa is incredibly proud of her son for this. She says she doesn't know if he'll choose to live waste-free when he's older, but he's on his own journey. And ultimately, that's what she advises everyone to do.
You don't have to give plastic up entirely tomorrow morning. You know, any step is a positive step. I think start small, you know, start with something achievable and then congratulate yourself for every step that you have taken.
For the World, Brenna Daldorf, London.
At least half of children around the globe are suffering from malnutrition. That's the bottom line in a surprising new report from UNICEF. But when we say the word malnutrition, it doesn't just mean lack of food, as the World's Alana Gordon reports.
In the past, malnutrition was mainly seen as a problem of scarcity. Too many children in too many countries just didn't have enough to eat. The problem for millions of people in rich and poor countries is different now.
They may not lack food altogether, but they lack nutritious food.
Lawrence Chandy is the author of the new UNICEF report. He dug into years of malnutrition data from around the globe. Chandy says the modern world presents a whole different set of challenges when it comes to nutrition.
We estimate that at least one in two children globally suffer from hidden hunger.
Hidden hunger means that families may be able to get plenty of cheap food, but not the right kind of food, like the fruits and vegetables that are essential for young kids. And again, that number is staggering. We're talking about at least half of all children on Earth. UNICEF found that 150 million children worldwide are too short for their age, and that more and more kids are eating poorer and poorer diets much earlier in life. And that brings us to another modern-day problem, obesity. Chandy says obesity is sharply on the rise, even among young kids. And this isn't just in poorer countries.
We're as likely to have instances of malnutrition in middle-income countries, households still with relatively few resources, but more than they had before. They often are in urban areas, so they're not growing their food, they're buying their food.
It is definitely a call to arms. Child undernutrition has major consequences.
Wafai Fauzi is a nutrition expert at Harvard. He worries about the long-term cognitive development of kids who aren't getting the right kinds of nutrients. He says the solutions to global malnutrition have to address the source of where food comes from.
For a long time, nutrition and health really have been sort of the domain of ministries of health and nutrition programs within ministries of health. But a growing recognition exists that engaging with the agricultural sector is important.
Fauzi says the global food system focuses too much on carbohydrates and growing corn and wheat. It needs to include more vegetables and fruits that people can afford. But there are some bright spots. One example is in Serbia. Dr. Jelena Gudenrakic directs a Center for Health Promotion at Serbia's Institute for Public Health.
Because we still have the tradition of green markets, which are open every day, and people usually go shopping for these goods during the weekends, and families still tend to keep their family meals.
UNICEF highlighted that more than 95% of Serbian kids are getting the fruits and vegetables they need. But Gudenrakic worries about the ways of the modern world reversing this success story. She says she's starting to see signs of obesity and malnutrition creep in. For the World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Rules are meant to be broken. That could be the theme for this year's Booker Prize, the prestigious literary award for fictional works written in English. The judges are instructed to choose one winner. This year, they just couldn't. Their two choices are women whose feminist works have also broken the rules, Canadian writer Margaret Atwood and British-Nigerian writer Bernadine Evaristo.
It would have been quite embarrassing for me, a good Canadian, because we don't do famous. We think it's in bad taste. It would have been embarrassing if I had been alone here.
This is incredible. I suppose a lot of people say this. I never thought it would happen to me. And I will say that I am the first black woman to win this prize.
Atwood won for The Testaments, the sequel to her iconic book, The Handmaid's Tale, and Evaristo received the Booker for her novel, Girl, Woman, Other. The BBC's Vincent Dowd spoke to the winners last night. He asked Evaristo if she was shocked to find herself sharing the award with Margaret Atwood.
Did you not see my face? Absolutely, yes. Didn't know it at all.
No, I was completely surprised.
To win the prize is amazing. To share it with Margaret Atwood is amazing.
Bonesy, is it the first time you've won a really big award?
This is the biggest award I've won, for sure. I got an MBE, but that's not quite the same. That's an honour.
There's a photo of you in the book. You look like you might be wearing Doc Martens. You're definitely like it's 30 years ago or whatever. When you look at that, do you think, how on earth did I ever get to this point, or does it seem a natural progression?
My God, it's not a natural progression. When I was that age, I didn't know about the Booker. I wasn't a writer, I was an actor. I would never have thought I would have the career that I have. You can't see that far when you're young. You know, I was an actor, and then I became a writer, and I still felt very much on the outside. And then I was published by Penguin, and that changed things a bit. And now this incredible kind of stamp of approval.
For both of you, what turned you into being a writer? Because when we look at it from this end, we think it's natural, but it wasn't natural for you when you were both 20.
I actually rather foolishly decided I was going to be a writer when I was 16, and that was Canada in the 50s, and nobody was a writer. I made that decision out of ignorance. If I had known how hard it was, I probably would not have done it.
I started writing through theatre because there were no plays for us to perform as black women. So I started writing plays for black women and then left theatre behind but continued to write and found that writing was the thing that gave me the most satisfaction and it was a way for me to be a voice in the world.
So in the theatre, have things improved in terms of diversity, and in literature, in publishing rather, have things improved?
To a degree, but not as much. We're still not getting truly diverse literature published in this country at a level at which we should be, and theatres are still mainly run by white men. But I think things have changed a lot in the last 40 years, for sure. People need to open their eyes to different voices, different stories, and be very careful about who they choose to judge prizes in order to make sure that they are as inclusive as they can be.
Margaret, you get £25,000. That's very nice. What are you going to do with it?
It's my belief at this moment in history, especially with the climate crisis, that in North America and Canada, where I'm from, we need to move Indigenous people to the center of nature stewardship. So I'm putting it into something I'd already started, which is a scholarship for Indigenous students in environmental studies. And it's run through an organization called INDSPIRE, which does scholarships for Indigenous students. And it's named after a friend of mine who died called Chief Harry St. Dennis.
Do you think the judges might have been thinking at some level about sharing things, meeting people halfway?
My personal opinion is that prizes that are shared are a good thing because the love is spread and more people are rewarded for the work that they do. And we've both written women-centered feminist books, but from very different perspectives. That's something that, you know, is to be celebrated. Joint winners, but we've written these really strong feminist texts.
The authors Bernadine Evaristo and Margaret Atwood, co-recipients of this year's Booker Prize, Atwood for her novel The Testaments and Evaristo for the novel Girl, Woman, Other. They were speaking after last night's awards with the BBC's Vincent Dowd. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Join us again tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.